Welcome to the Student of the Game Fire Podcast with your host, Danny B. Today's guest is Stephen Barger, 16 years of combination experience, a lieutenant, paramedic, and police officer with Bald Head Island Department of Public Safety in North Carolina. No, your ears aren't deceiving you, as Steve holds all three positions. Bald Head has a very unique and challenging way of operating for the residents and visitors. While you don't hear very many stories like Bald Head, what I hope the listeners appreciate is how Steve and others within the department view their situation and not let it deter them from being all in when it comes to physical fitness, training, and basic skills of the job. Steve also openly discusses his struggles when it comes to firefighter wellness and how he overcame what some cannot. With that, I present Mr. Stephen Barger.
Stephen Barger, currently a lieutenant in the Village of Bald Head Island Department of Public Safety. I've been in the fire service for about 16 years now, and currently I'm a police officer, a paramedic, and a firefighter at a true public safety agency over on the island.
So some of the guests are going to be like, wait, what did he just say? So police officer, first responder, and firefighter.
Yes, sir.
All in one.
Yeah, it's a complicated model. And I know there's a lot of places that do police and fire together, but having transport EMS as part of our response plan is definitely unique for us. We're on a barrier island off the coast of North Carolina that doesn't have a bridge to it. We have to ride a boat to work. And everybody that comes and goes from the island has to ride a boat as well. There's very few cars on the island. It's mostly golf carts. So the only vehicles, motor vehicles on the island are the village-owned ones, so public safety. Public works, and then the contractors are allowed to have vehicles as well. It takes a special permit to do that. So it's mostly golf carts on the island. And so because of the uniqueness of it, we staff with six people and we cover all three mechanisms of public safety every day.
Okay, so for those that don't know, including myself, can you talk about Bald Head Island public safety, ranging from the apparatus that you have for police, for EMS, and for fire, along with your staffing and your current deployment model on your your tactics, but what you guys would drop on an alarm assignment?
Yes, sir. So we staff with six people when we're fully staffed, and so all six of those people are certified in as either EMTs or paramedics. All certified as North Carolina firefighters, and all certified with minimum basic law enforcement, which is the police certification here in North Carolina. And so those six people are responsible for responding to fire calls, EMS calls, and police calls. Each shift kind of does it differently. So currently I'm a lieutenant, which is the shift commander role, and I have a sergeant that works with me as well. And so we kind of mirror more of the law enforcement rank structure, but we also operate, you know, with the normal company officer role where, you know, we do the shift training and the calendar and all the scheduling and stuff like a normal company officer would do in the fire service. So on any given day, we staff our engine. We run a two-man engine company. We run the rescue engine concept currently just because of our staffing model and having to take different vehicles and different types of calls. So we do run a rescue engine as our first out. We also have a ladder truck and a second out engine. And we do have a number of volunteers who help us get the apparatus to the scene too. And a few of those are interior certified firefighters as well. So on any given day, the six people who are on shift, two people are going to be assigned to the ambulance, two people are going to be assigned to the engine, and two people are going to be assigned to law. And for law enforcement, we use Toyota Tacoma pickup trucks as our patrol vehicles because we have a beach and everything and the four-wheel drive and the clearance of those getting over our accesses just makes that more ergonomic for us. And then we just run standard ambulances over there as well. The one unique thing for us is, you know, when we transport a medical patient on the ambulance, we transport them from the scene to the marina. We put them on the ferry, on the stretcher, and we ride with them. And once we get to the mainland, we actually transfer the care to the county EMS system on the other side, and then we ride the boat back. The only time that gets a little complicated is after the ferry doesn't run, because it doesn't run for 24 hours. So depending on the time of day, anywhere from 9 p.m. to midnight, the ferry shuts down for the night. And so we have a great partnership with the U.S. Coast Guard, and they come over and grab us and help us ferry people back and forth as needed, and infrastructure fires as well, because our auto aid obviously has to come over by boat as well. So that's the other unique thing about us, is when we have a structure fire, our first alarm is not only our station, but the city of Southport and the town of Oak Island respond with engine companies as well. But when we say they come with an engine company, they're coming with their people, their tools, and their air packs, but they're not bringing fire trucks with them. And they have to ride over on a boat as well.
That is very unique. Okay. What's the response time on a working structure fire with having to transport personnel?
Yeah, so our response time, we pride ourselves on our response time. Obviously, we're already on the island. So we put an engine company, an ambulance, six people on the fire ground within about 5 minutes. And then we have, depending on the volunteers that are on the island that day, we have a number of volunteers who come and help us. So most of them are capable of pumping the truck, helping us get lines deployed, setting up water supply, all that kind of stuff. So we could put six people in an active firefighting role pretty quickly. And then from there, the city of Southport, their engine company, and Oak Island's engine company responds to the Coast Guard station. And it takes about 30 minutes to get them on scene, typically, because they have to drive to the Coast Guard station, get all their equipment on there, and then they ride over. And then that also sets off the tones for our admin staff, who doesn't live on the island. So they respond to the ferry landing with whoever else gets the call, because we all utilize an app on our phone to get the calls. So myself and a few others live pretty close to the ferry, and so we respond to the ferry, and our chiefs will get there. We ride over either on the second run with the Coast Guard, or if the ferry is able to get up and going, and then we go over to, and we supplement staffing with our off-duty personnel.
And about how many volunteers do you have that live on the main island?
Yes, yeah, so all of our volunteers have to live on the island, and we have about 25 of those.
Okay.
And again, they all operate in various roles. Some of them are just rehab, so they set up rehab and stuff like that. Some of them are actual operational, where they put an air pack on and they fight fire with us. And others are more of a firefighter support role, where they can drive trucks, they can pump trucks, they can drag hose with us and stuff. They're just not able to actually fight fire wearing an air pack or anything like that.
Okay. And what's your square miles in for Bald Head Island?
So the island is about 7 miles long and about 3 miles wide. It's heavily wooded. I always jokingly tell people when I take them over to the island, welcome to Jurassic Park, because most of the island is a protected maritime forest. So it's heavily wooded. There's a very thick tree canopy until you get to the beach, obviously. And the beach is wide open, like most beach towns. We have pretty large houses over there. There's no small beach houses on the island at all. So most of our fires are 3,000 square foot houses and above. And with the coastal winds that we have, obviously wind-driven fires are our biggest challenge. Back in 2020, we had a fire that's been known as the Lighthouse Landing Fire. It got a lot of publicity, like in the media and stuff like that, and different firefighter pages. That was my shift that night. We had 19-mile-an-hour sustained winds. When we got there was already four houses on fire. And so you can imagine with the staffing miles, which is about with six people, and trying to stop, that many structures with a wind-driven fire. We've got a great group of folks that work with us. The men and women that work with us, they know the assignment. They know the challenges that present on that. And I think that's one of the hardest things, and I'm sure we'll talk about it more, is in a small agency that doesn't go to a lot of fires, is making sure that your readiness is the same as everybody else around you. And I always tell everybody, we're not too far from the city of Wilmington, which is a pretty large city here in North Carolina. And I always tell, my folks and everybody else at our agency, that the expectations of Baldwin Island Public Safety is no different than those people who live in Wilmington and their expectations of the Wilmington Fire Department, right? So we have to be just as fast, just as good, and just as capable at carrying out the task, knowing our assignments, knowing our tactics. Even though we don't use it a lot, we have to be good at it. And that's where artificially creating a lot of experiences for people can be tough. And that just really, it hammers down on your training, going to outside classes, because company training enough isn't, company training alone isn't enough, because you're putting yourself into a box of knowledge that doesn't ever improve or that box of knowledge never has external factors bringing other experiences, right? So company training is vital. It's the basis of training here in the fire service. But we got to make sure we're sending people out to external classes as well as they come available.
So approximately, what's your call average yearly? Approximately, it doesn't have to be exact.
Yeah, we run in the ballpark of 2,000 calls a year. That's all three call types, though. So that's
Gotcha.
our law enforcement calls. That includes traffic stops, burglar alarms, all that kind of stuff. That's our EMS calls as well. And then our fire calls, which typically are fire alarms like everywhere else. Motor vehicle accidents, which typically involve golf carts. And that's the other thing is, when you tell people that you work at a place that is mostly golf carts, even out there by you, outside of Charlotte, golf carts are becoming much more frequent on roadways, especially in these smaller communities that have HOAs and stuff that allow them their smaller, HOA roads or whatever it may be. And the thing about golf carts is most of the time people aren't wearing seatbelts. There's no steel to hold them inside of it. And so if they hit each other or hit something else, that typically results in some sort of ejection or partial ejection. And people can really get hurt on golf carts. People get killed on golf carts all the time. And so that's kind of been a mission of mine on the island is, trying to make sure people are putting their kids in car seats, making sure they're wearing seat belts, just paying attention to what's around them. Unfortunately, people, a lot of their experiences until they get to a place like that is, well, they're driving a golf cart on a golf course where you can drink beer while you're doing it, where there's not, any traffic laws to follow and that kind of stuff. So it's really an educational thing that we have to do on the island. Just like other places, to make sure we're educating people that these things still can hurt and kill you. And I think we're having a good result with that.
No, understood. Understood. Okay. So, one of the questions that I want to ask you is, how do you find the balance between continuing education of your EMTs, your paramedics, also holding up your continuing ed, which I think that's a thing, because I mean, I don't know. So that's why I'm asking about the police officer side, and then your continuing ed for fire. How does bald head factor all that in?
Yeah, so it's delicate, and that's one of the important roles, in that shift commander role is making sure that everybody is checking all those boxes they have to each year. It's just like an EMS certification. There's mandatory yearly in-service you have to do for law enforcement as well. I'd say the fire service is the least rigid with that. Obviously you have your minimums for your ISO requirements and your 35 hours to maintain your volunteer fire stuff and all that. But yeah, so we are a franchise of Brunswick County EMS. Any EMS agency in the state of North Carolina that is not the county is basically a contracted franchise, even out there by you where you have Medic. So, counties have the authority to run EMS. So Mecklenburg County contracts with Medic. So here we have Brunswick County EMS in our county, which is a county ran agency, but we do have some other ambulances that are contracted franchises. Village of Bald Head Island is one of them. The city of Southport has one as well. And so we work with the county. They hold quarterly Con Ed topics, and all of our folks go through that. And then we also train on shift for our EMS skills as well with our equipment. And then as far as law enforcement goes, I think that's one of the most unique things about our law enforcement is because we have a lot of fire service leaders in our department. They take more of a fire service approach where a lot of law enforcement agencies, because law enforcement is just so different. Typically, you get in your car for 12 hours and you don't come back to the police building. So they don't do as much on shift training in law enforcement typically as we do in the fire service. But we're blending that at Bald Head Island. So we do a lot of daily training too for law enforcement. So the way we do it on our shift is we just rotate. So I go back on tour tomorrow, and tomorrow is an EMS day, so we'll do EMS training tomorrow. But when we go back on Saturday, that's a law enforcement training day. So we will have a law enforcement topic. And so that's how we rotate it on my shift. All shifts are different. So, and again, that goes back into what we were just talking about as far as your shift training, but also your institutional training through your community colleges or those weekend fire schools that have at various places, and making sure that you're getting folks in classes so that they're expanding that knowledge base outside of just your agency.
Okay. And what would happen if you had an EMS call that required transport, because I'm assuming Bald Head Island does not have a hospital on the island, correct?
Correct.
So what's the case where you get an EMS call, the person definitely needs hospital care, and you said that you if the ferry's not there, you call the Coast Guard, and let's just say the two first responders that are treating the patient go off. And then you get another call. I guess does the next crew that's on either the rescue engine or even the police officers, do they intervene on the next EMS call while those two are already off the island?
Absolutely. Yeah. So we have a second ambulance. So the ambulance doesn't go off the island. So as far as the apparatus goes, we have the ability to get another EMS apparatus there. And so, yeah, the engine, we might have to dump the engine and just run the ambulance. And then the police folks will come back and staff the engine for us. Again, everybody's certified and everything. So even if they're assigned to police that day, they still have their fire gear with them. And they're still EMS certified folks, no matter what apparatus they're assigned to. And we rotate that. So like again on my shift, we rotate every third shift onto it. So tomorrow I'll be the company officer on the engine. But on Saturday when we go back, I'll be on patrol. So again, it's just a good rotation. That keeps everybody honed on their skills as well. You know, especially being at a place that doesn't run a ton of calls, you gotta make sure you're staying in the game, right? Just like your podcast is called. It's like you got to make sure that you're keeping your hands on it all the time. I still have the ambulance, every third shift as well, because I think it's important to keep those skills up. And that's a big thing as far as having high expectations and accountability for my folks is having high expectations and accountability for me. Because I always tell people when they come to my shift, I have a little PowerPoint that I put together over the years, and I take input from my folks on that as well. And one of the biggest things is I have high expectations for you. I'm going to hold you accountable. But that goes up and down the chain. I want you to have high expectations for me and hold me accountable as well. Because in a group of people, we're all leaders and we all have to hold each other accountable. And when you build that trust with your folks, it just gives you a much better product. Because you don't have to worry about going into a fire and knowing somebody's capabilities, right? Or trusting that person's not gonna get scared and, boogie out the door on you or anything like that. And in a law enforcement situation, heaven forbid you end up in any kind of shooting, knowing that the guy with you that you trust him, he's going to hold you accountable and you're going to hold him accountable as well.
Oh yes, I want to make sure I didn't lose this question. It popped back up. So I'm assuming with most like beach areas, the summertime is probably your most busiest time. Do you increase your staffing during that time, or do you keep it the same at six?
Yeah, so our full-time staffing stays the same. We do have part-time officers that work with us sometimes. And so during the summertime, they will approve one or two extra people per day, depending on the availability of our part-timers to come in and work those shifts. So we do sometimes staff upwards of eight people. And then obviously holidays. So you got Memorial Day, you got Labor Day, 4th of July. All those holidays get upstaffed typically with three additional people, even if it's overtime, just because that brings so many more people. Since COVID, it's been really hard to track how many people live full time on Bald Head Island, but our population is probably six times the normal during the summer. So there's a lot more people. The call volume skyrockets, and then like you kind of mentioned earlier, that sends more of our folks off the island on medical transports, or if somebody's arrested, or more fire calls. It doesn't have to be a structure fire to tax our system. It could be a kitchen fire. It could be, a golf cart fire, because a lot of those have lithium batteries now. So we know with the introduction of these lithium batteries in vehicles, how difficult that can be. When you got three or four golf carts parked underneath the house charging, overcharging, you have these lithium battery fires. We have that challenge just like people do with these EV vehicles, smaller scale, but still taxes our system. It's kind of like mass casualty and EMS. They talk about mass casualty doesn't really have a number. Mass casualty is whatever taxes your system. The argument can be made that every call outside of just your run-of-the-mill, somebody fell or a traffic stop or a fender bender wreck, almost every call taxes our system just because of our staffing and our unique location. We don't have the ability to, be on a wreck and bang out the next engine company from the next district even. because that's a 30-minute process to even get that to happen.
That is wild. That's crazy. Just, I mean, never thought about it that way. But that's, yeah, no, that's something to think about right there for your response times, your manpower, issues with multiple calls. And I'm sure you've had that where you get concurrent calls and it's just like, holy cow, like what, yeah, man. Okay.
I gotta tell you, our admin does a really good job too of, monitoring for us. And there's times where we have to stack calls. They might not be a high enough acuity to bring in mutual aid. So we might have to stack, low level calls. And that's happened before. It doesn't happen all the time, but it has happened before where, we might have two people off on a medical transport and we might have two people on a law call they can't break away from. And so, that engine company might be, three fire alarms stacked on them. They're just going to keep responding to them as they came in. That happens frequently. Again, because we can't just bang out the neighboring engine company or truck company or anything like that.
No, understood. Understood. Okay. And what kind of schedule do you guys work? Because you mentioned you're going to work tomorrow, which would be Tuesday, but then you go back Saturday.
Yeah, so we probably have the best shift schedule out there right now, which is 24/72s.
Oh, yes, you do. Lucky. Lucky.
And so we have four shifts as opposed to three. And I've worked every different shift schedule over the years. I worked 24/48s when I was at Horry County Fire Rescue, and I worked that one off, 4 off schedule when I was in Pender County. And the 24/72s is great life and that work life balance. But I also understand the cost of, my side hustle is I'm involved in local politics. I'm the chairman of the school board here in Brunswick County. And so understanding government budgets, I probably have a unique understanding compared to most first responders just because I'm involved in it all the time. And obviously 24/72s cost more money for the local municipality, but it's a recruiting tool for us because, new firemen want to go to busy fire stations where they can go to a lot of fires or a lot of wrecks. New police officers are the same thing. They want to answer a lot of calls, new paramedics, and we don't have that. So we have to create a unique recruiting tool. And that schedule is just one of those things that we can utilize for our advantages. You only have to work 7 or 8 days a month, depending on how your schedule falls.
Man, I don't want to go off topic, but I have to ask because you mentioned you have the knowledge. And I always hear that 24/72s are great. Yes, all right, your municipality, your town, your city is going to take a hit. But at the end of the day, is it really a hit? Doesn't it all play out at the end? Because number one, it's a huge recruitment tool to me. Number two, it really shows the firefighters and EMTs that you have, depending on your level of service, you actually care. Because one of the things I'm seeing is I've seen all these advertisements and these political figureheads that say, hey, we care about our employees, this, that, and the other. Not saying they don't, but they always talk about that they do. And it's like, well, to me, my personal opinion, I'm like, show us, like, show it. And I understand you. To hire a whole nother shift is another game in itself, but it can be done, correct?
Absolutely. So, you can look at cost versus price on anything. When you go to the grocery store, there's the price of something, and then there's the cost of ownership, right? And I always use that because the thing that has the cheapest price doesn't always have the best cost of ownership. All right. So if you take that theory in widgets or things and apply it to your employees, okay, there's a price of having this group of employees, but then there's the cost benefit of having this group of employees. So our turnover is low because of that shift schedule. Our municipality has said we do care about family and your time at home. I think it boils down to mental health as well, especially in these busy services, where if you're on 24/48s and you're on an engine company that's running 15 calls a shift, wherever it may be, or you're up all night, so your sleep pattern is definitely interrupted when you're on shift. We'll just put it that way. You get home that next day, most likely you're not 100% for your family. You're not showing up ready. And then you have the next day, you're basically preparing to go to work. So I think it's horrible for mental health, the 24/48s. And I know there's been that introduction of that 48/96 scale. I've never worked with that. I've seen a lot of the research and the data on it. That might be a solution for some people, but I think the 24 72 again helps people have a normal family life. Look at divorce rates for first responders, they're sky high. Look at substance abuse for first responders, it's higher than your average person. And having that time away from work, being able to decompress. And I don't, I don't always get into all the blood and gore of it of, oh, you see, dead bodies all the time, or you see this, and your job is hard. Of course the job is hard. But just because the job is hard doesn't mean you have to have time away. You need to have time away because you need to build purposeful relationships and be present at home for your family, even for yourself. Even if you're not married, you don't have any kids. It's important to have a life outside the fire service as well. I'm a firm believer that that makes you a better firefighter, a better fire service leader, being able to have that time away.
No, I agree. I agree.
So
And
yeah,
you.
I'm there is a price to it, but I think the cost is much less than the price. And I
Right.
think more people that are open-minded about that schedule, the better off they can be. And for us, it works because, most firemen don't want to be cops, right? That's why they're firemen. Most cops don't want to be firemen. So, for us, it's a recruiting tool because we're potentially, in some instances, putting somebody out of their comfort zone. And so, near me, the city of North Myrtle Beach had a public safety model for a lot of years. I think they've recently kind of gone away from it, but their firefighters were some sort of police officer. South Carolina has a little bit different way they serve police officers, but and then their police officers were firefighters. And I know a lot of guys down there. Chief Floyd taught my rookie school in Horry County, and so for a lot of years there was the jokes. The cops would show up, put their turnout gear on, kind of stand in the front yard and look cool. The cops would give the firemen a hard time too, and but we physically have to do it every day, so. I think that schedule just really helps us recruit people. And even if we're having to put them out of position, we're able to thank them through having a schedule that works better for them.
Okay. All right. So my kind of first official question for you, training on a budget. I'm not sure what your budget is for Bald Head Island, but how do you try to bring, or how does your command staff try to bring in realistic training in for your members? And you said it earlier, you're not burning as much, but the potential's always there. Your situation is very, very, very unique. So what does Bald Head Island do for their membership to kind of bring that in?
Yeah, so we don't do as much bringing outside instructors to the island because logistically it's tough. And then we also have, holding a class on the island, then trying to get 20 people, 10 people to the island, via the ferry, we would have low attendance. And so what we typically do is in North Carolina, just like a lot of other states, the fire service, EMS, and police training is free as long as you're affiliated with agency. And so, Cape Fear Community College does a great job. They hold four fire colleges throughout the year. And those things have basic firefighting courses, leadership courses, more advanced live fire courses, all that kind of stuff. So, we like to take advantage of sending our folks to other places because that also helps them build that network, right? So, instead of only knowing the people that live in your neighborhood, now you're expanding that network and you're allowing people to build relationships and have a network. So, especially for our company officers, if somebody comes to you with a question and you don't know the answer, you have that network you can call to find the answer out, right? That's the mark of a good leader, even is just knowing that you can say, hey, you're no BS, don't make an answer up. I don't know the answer to that, but I know somebody I can call. And so sending people out to classes, again, just helps them build that network and improves their knowledge base. It's building relationships and it's a recruiting tool for us. Because when people show, when our folks go to a class, they put on our turnout gear, they have our helmet front on their helmet, Bald Head Island. People are always asking, where's Bald Head? Most people have never heard of it before. And so then you start talking about the uniqueness of it. Yeah, I ride a boat to work every day. We have 24/72s. If you've ever been, interested in policing or something, you can do that. It's just such a unique thing. So as far as bringing training in-house, we typically don't do that. We just send our folks out. And again, that's super beneficial for us because for mainland departments, they can get together more. Our mutual aid training is more difficult. We do bring people to the island, from Oak Island, Southport periodically to do training on the island, and we go over there with them as well. But it's just important to expose our folks to more things, especially if we get somebody who doesn't have a ton of experience other places. If their only experience is on Baldhead Island, we absolutely have to invest in those people and broaden their horizon.
No, I like the way you look at it. I mean, it's the truth. Like I said, with your situation, yeah, I didn't think about that. A lot of departments not on an island, like, hey, we're gonna do quarterly training with our mutual aid partners. Okay, it's very easy. All right, whose training facility are we gonna go to? Whereas with you guys, yeah, bringing in, I can't imagine the logistics. And I mean, and the fact that, you mentioned, like, if you were to do some sort of training on the island, you said like your numbers are going to be low because you have to bring in people from a ferry back and forth. Like that is very, very challenging. So I totally understand that.
Yeah, and the mutual aid training is even difficult because if Oak Island was to send an engine company over to Baldhead to train with us for a few hours, they're out of service for their own district
Right.
because they can't
Right.
just jump on the rig and ride
Right.
on back to Oak Island.
That's crazy. Man, okay. Man, yeah, that's just I'm just thinking about it. I've seen it in movies where like you might laugh at this, but the movie that comes to mind was I think it was I Know What You Did Last Summer when they were when they won the Julie won the tickets to go to an island and the only way to get there was by boat, and of course the killer's on the island, not that very many people on the island, just the fact that to call for help minus the resources only that are on the island, like that's all you have. And that's something you guys have to kind of deal with. So what was it like? I'm gonna kind of go back a little bit. What was it like as far as when you had that multi-alarm fire? I mean, to the control of that, you arrive on location, you got four homes going. You're calling a mutual aid, that's at least 30 minutes. Like, I just can't imagine. And your manpower, if you had 6 to 9 to 10 people there on four homes going, that's got to be very challenging.
Yeah, so I'll be honest with you. We've sent a lot of our folks through Jonah Smith's
Oh, Hornet Fire
bit.
Training.
His big water classes.
Okay.
I've become friends with him over the years as well. He vacations to Oak Island quite a bit, and he's actually come to the island a couple of times. And just because he's local, when he vacations to Oak Island, he's done a few things with us, and he's been a great mentor and asset for me because he talks about big water on fire. So, going back to that lighthouse landing fire, I was actually on patrol that night. And my partner, the other lady on patrol, Amanda, she's since left us and gone on to state law enforcement. But we had just ridden by there and we were going to do some business checks. So 5 minutes before that fire came out, we had rode through there. There was no smoke in the roadway and we didn't see anything. That's how quickly that fire happened. After the investigation, I think they determined the fire was in the house. And once it got external and broke a window, got outside the house with that 19-mile-an-hour wind, it was a blowtorch, right? So we roll up. She beat me about a minute or two before me, and her size up. I could hear in her voice, it was an oh shit moment. And so I rolled up behind her. I said, "Let's get these patrol vehicles out of the way. Cops love to park in the way. I can say that because I am one." So, we got our vehicles out of the way. I took command immediately, and I was able to, because I beat the engine there, I wasn't on the engine that day, I was able to really get a good scene assessment. I'm not gonna lie, until I was able to get a 360 with that many houses on fire, but I was able to get a good scene assessment, spot two hydrants, and give the incoming engine some decent direction. So they laid their own line. And we got the master stream and two portable master streams in service real quickly. It was a defensive attack from the get-go. And so we stopped it. So there was a cul-de-sac that had seven structures on it. There was four of them on fire when we got there. The fifth one lit off as we were laying our lines, but we stopped it there. So to me, that was a win. The houses were like 10 feet apart. The fact that we stopped it where it was when we got there, I think is hats off to my folks. They got big water on the fire very quickly. And it was a densely wooded area, so there was chainsaws involved. They were trying to cut tunnels to pull hose through. And then when Oak Island and Southport got there, because we work with them hand in hand regularly, they brought their assistant chief over. I was able to give him a division. He went right on down there. Again, we used like tactics, so I was able to send Chief Coring down there into that cul-de-sac. He was able to manage that for me. And then on the Bravo division, when Oak Island's company officer got there, I was able to give him that. And so, we just worked it from two sides, and it was chaos. It was crisis. Leading through crisis is never comfortable for anybody. But
Right.
again, it's just getting the bulk of the fire knocked down, trying to beat the winds. It's almost like using wildfire tactics when you have winds that high. You just got to get in front of it and try and cut it off. And once we got that last house that I caught, it was about 50% involved. Once I got that knocked down, I was able to send a crew in there because it was still sturdy. They got a search done and got some interior firefighter knocked down so they get some of their belongings out.
Okay. All right. Man, I'm telling you, from the beginning, when you mentioned how everything works, I was so intrigued. I forgot to ask you one of my main questions that I like to ask all the guests. So that is, how did you get into the fire service?
Yeah, so I think like most men, when I was a little boy, I was intrigued by fire trucks, and I grew up in a small town that had a small fire department, three fire stations, and we'd go visit it and that kind of stuff. And I had asthma as a kid, so being a firefighter was kind of out of the question for me. I had a lot of allergies and stuff like that, so I actually went to college, the intention of going to law school. And during that time, my mom had gotten breast cancer, and she's been in remission for a lot of years now. I'm thankful for that. But when my mom got cancer, I took a break from college, and I had some friends who were going to EMT school. So I was like, "Hey, how do you get into that?" And so I went to EMT school, and in Ohio, where I grew up, you had to be a paramedic to be a firefighter. It's fire-based EMS in almost all areas in Ohio, and so I did that. And when I got done with all my training, I was 22 years old, and living in Ohio and dealing with the snow really wasn't my thing. And so I tested all over. First call I got back was here in Brunswick County at the coast of North Carolina. And I was like, man, go live at the beach, single guy, no kids, no responsibility. And so here I am. And my career has taken me a couple different places. I've worked county EMS. I've worked for large fire agencies like Orange County Fire Rescue. And when I got married, I went to Pender County EMS and Fire. I went there as an EMS lieutenant and ended up being a company officer on a heavy rescue engine there in Pender County. And then as we had kids, the 24/72 schedule was something that I sought after. And I was working part-time at Baldhead Island at the time. So I was able to work something out with the chief to go full time there.
So upon taking the position, well, actually, I want to back up a little bit. You mentioned Horry County. So you were in Ohio, and then you didn't want the winter and the cold, and I get it, totally get that 100%. So then when you left Ohio to go where?
Right here in Southport. I've lived here since I lived in Little River there, just outside Myrtle Beach for a couple of years, for about a year with a couple of firemen, just to kind of get my roots here. I bought this house that we still live in, actually. So, and that was in 2008.
So then, upon taking the position with Baldhead, I'm assuming you knew going into it like you had to have your law enforcement because you had your EMS already, all your EMS credentials and your fire credentials, but it's like in order to come work here, you got to go take your law enforcement. Was that something that you wanted to do, or is this something you're like, all right, I guess I'll try it?
Yeah, so I'd always been interested in it. I've been involved in special operations, SWAT, medic stuff a couple times throughout my career, and so I kind of was intrigued by law enforcement. I was never certified as a law enforcement officer, but I definitely had an interest in it. So going to Baldhead, I knew I had to go through the BLET program, and they pay you to go to it. So basically, that was my job for 6 months. Was I didn't go to the island, I didn't go to shift, and Monday through Friday, I just went to BLET. That was challenging a little bit for for the family, obviously. I've never worked a day job, or I haven't in years. But I was able to do it, get paid while I went there. The training was free. And so it just worked out. I would have never been able to work full time with myself through BLET,
All right.
with my wife and my kids and stuff. So I look at it as a blessing. They invested in me and gave me the skills, and I was able to really get into something that I was interested in, and I've really enjoyed it ever since.
Okay. All right. I have a question for you. I know, at least from where I work, fire and EMS and law kind of go hand in hand, especially on psychiatric calls, domestic type calls, situations like that. But you have a unique perspective. So my question is, and only answer if you feel comfortable. I always like to throw that out there. Why is it that sometimes, like, all right, let's just you we're going to use some sort of psychiatric call, right? Your patient ingested a bunch of pills because they're going through something or whatever the case may be. Fire gets there usually first, scene secure, blah, blah, blah. We go in, we're calm, cool, collective, and then law enforcement will get there, right? Why is it that like they have to, and I'm not saying all, but it's just my experience where I feel like, and even the individuals that are on my truck, we'll all kind of agree. It's like when law enforcement gets there, they give off a vibe like, I need to know what they took, I need to know it now. Like, why is it that? Because you have a perspective where you have it from all sides. You're certified on all sides. Is it a law enforcement thing where they have to, I don't want to say like show dominance, but they have to have the answers or whatever, like right then and there. Instead of keeping the vibe chill, it's like it always changes when a cop shows up on scene.
So I think my perspective is not going to be the perspective of everybody's. Because I started in fire and EMS, we are trained in fire and EMS to deal with people differently than
Right,
police officers
right.
are from the get-go. And I don't fault either side for that. But I've learned working with traditional police officers that we've turned into firefighters and EMTs, and then working with firefighter EMTs that we've turned into police officers, what makes them tick different. And going through both academies, I can tell you that the academies have a different theme about them. And we're seeing that change in modern policing as well. So let's not forget that policing's been changing. The 21st Century Policing Initiative that was started by the federal government a number of years ago kind of changed that. The community policing introduction, again, re relationship building, bridge building. But the jobs are different, right? So in fire and EMS, our job is not punitive. It never has been. But police officers have been in kind of a punitive role for a number of years. Look at the risk analysis of both jobs. Typically, again, I know in modern ages, paramedics and firemen have come under fire. But, police officers aren't walking into safe situations all the time, as opposed to we are most of the time. We're the engine company and the ambulance gets to stage around the corner until law enforcement says the scene is safe. I don't know if you guys do that in your area, but that's a common thing around us. If you have an overdose or a domestic or anything like that, we stage and wait for law enforcement to tell us to come in. So I think the perspective is very different. Now, our call type on the island I work on is also very different than a lot of other police agencies. So I would say both sides need to give each other grace. How's that? Because the perspectives in the job are very different. Even though they cross and they mesh all the time, the roles are still defined to be very different.
Okay.
Does
No,
that
I'm
make sense?
tracking you. I'm tracking you. It's just always one of those things. It's like, the patient was, we got them to calm down, we got them to talk, and then as soon as, the law enforcement personnel walks in and is like, all right, I need your ID or whatever, it's just like they kind of, I don't want to say they make it worse, but the vibe definitely changes, and the patient either like just stops communicating altogether or they might upset the patient just a little bit, but I totally get it. It's a different, and I commend you because I would not want to do anything with law enforcement in this day and age, but I totally get it. from what you said, I'm tracking what you're saying.
Well, in communication skills, I think are taught differently. So in like fire and EMS, we'll talk about like on an EMS call, because that's typically where we deal with the most people in the fire service. Get down to their level, right? Get down on one knee.
Yes, yes.
You're more, you're trying to connect personally with them, because again, it's not typically a dangerous situation. By no means am I saying let your situational awareness go or anything like that, but
Right.
you're down on one knee, you're having a conversation with them. You're doing your assessment, whatever it may be. Law enforcement's not taught to get down on one knee in front of somebody who just committed a crime. And that's a dangerous situation for them. They have to have their head on a swivel, because they have their firearm on them. That can be detrimental to everybody in the room, including themselves. So, I think the heightened sense of awareness is just differently for police officers. And again, you mentioned an overdose. They could be working on an investigation for, a batch of dope that came in, and this is the third person they've seen overdose on the same drug, whatever it may be, the packaging and the imprints on, all that kind of stuff. So they might be walking in going, this drug dealer has gotten another person. They're frustrated that they haven't caught him yet. They want to catch him because they want less people to overdose, which means you're going to be responding to less overdoses. So, I try to always just go into a situation with grace and go, man, their perspective is different than mine, if that makes
No,
sense.
understood. No, understood loud and clear. Understood. Okay. as far as you were coming up in the fire service, was there one or a group of individuals that shaped you to see the fire service how you do now, where training, as you mentioned earlier, training is very important for your organization. Getting your members to go outside, which I think is huge, it's paramount. Like I truly believe you only know what you know. And I think with you having that comfortability of, well, I've been on my department for, I don't know, whatever, 20 years. I know my role, I know my job. But man, until you go outside and learn something new that you never thought, I think individuals are giving themselves a false sense of hope. But was there an individual or individuals that shaped you to form that mindset that you have now?
There's numerous people. Mike Norick, who's a battalion chief at Horry County Fire Rescue now, he was my captain when I was on Engine 34 down there. And I had gotten moved from a medic only station to medic 25 to Engine 34, which also was a medic unit. And so I rode the medic unit a lot. But I remember when I first got that assignment, there was some people talk, oh man, you're going to Norick shift. He was coming from Engine One, which saw a lot of fire, and they were the ones who trained all the time, and they would run 15 calls a shift, and oh, Norik's gonna have you out there training every day. I'm going, that's pretty cool, because I want to learn from that guy. Like I'm a lifelong learner. I always tell people, in any situation, I just went and helped with the drop-off line with my kids' elementary school this morning. I learned from that situation. Like I always enter a situation like, what can I learn from this? What can I absorb that's gonna maybe help me or help somebody else in the future? And so Chief Nork, again, he was my captain there, but he was big on training. Even with like weekly rig checks, we stripped the apparatus, we scrubbed the compartments, we cleaned all of our tools, not just because it was busy work, because if you had your hands on those things regularly, you are more familiar with them. It's more than just knowing where the axes and the halogens are, knowing when your extrication setup is, knowing where the hydrant bag is. But if you're cleaning that stuff and you have your hands on it, it's just like you can close your eyes and do it. Same with the pump panel. When you're a chauffeur, being able to have your pump panel memorized and know where your levers are, and fires don't ever happen in the middle of the day in perfect lighting situations, right? It's always at night. Your batteries are dead in your flashlight, whatever it may be. It's just having all that muscle memory. I just remember him always talking about being better, training, learning this, learning that. Even if it's a rainy day, then let's do some pump calculations on the board. Or if it's a rainy day, let's do some tabletops. The marker board was always full of lines and drawings and numbers, and it was just cool. And people would walk in the station and look at it like, what were you guys doing here? It didn't make sense to them, but our company was always ready. And again, that goes right back to that whole trust and leadership thing. I'll never forget, we had a fire. It was an Easter Sunday. I don't remember what year it was, but it's a double wide mobile home that had like a couple of additions on it, heavy fire load. And we go into this fire, And I'm with Norik, and never once did it cross my mind of I don't trust this guy. Every time he said he says saddle up and follow me. Yeah, Cap, I'm following you. Because we built that relationship in non-stressful situations. And so when you go to a smaller agency like mine, you have to continuously foster that relationship. It's like taking care of your garden. You can't go one day without watering it. You can't go
Right.
one day without growing it. Because those things can be eroded long before you actually realize it. And it's not always about motivation either. Even though I think, Norik was a very motivated guy, he was disciplined, right? Because I always tell people always tell me, man, Barger, why are you so motivated? I'm not. When I get out of bed at 3:30 in the morning to go run, it's not because I'm jumping out of bed motivated. It's because my discipline tells me that if I don't get up, my next marathon or ultra marathon is going to hurt like hell because I wasn't prepared, right? That's the discipline aspect that's much more important than just the motivation. Because motivation ebbs and flows, it's like a roller coaster. But if you're a disciplined individual, if you're a disciplined company, whether it's a truck or an engine or a rescue, if you have company discipline, you can still be really good on a day where you lack motivation.
Absolutely. That's 100% facts. 100%. Motivation only gets you so far. It's good. It's good for individuals to be motivated. I'm not trying to take that away from anybody, but motivation will only get you so far. It's the discipline that keeps you going day in, day out, even on the days you don't want to. 100% agree with you on that. 100%. With that being said, what does leadership look like for you?
I think that's an ever-evolving topic. It's probably even been over-documented over the years. I think we've overcomplicated it in some ways. I'm a big fan of John Maxwell's with my political arena, my public service in the fire service arena, and then just at home. Being a dad and a husband, a leader of the family, and by no means am I saying treat your household like a business, but it's showing up present every single day with discipline. And leadership is about influence, nothing more, nothing less. That's a big thing with John Maxwell is if you have no leader or if you have no influence, you're not a leader. Because to be a leader, you have to have people who are willing to follow you. And I think a lot of times we get hyped up, and I made this mistake early in my career. So, when I was a company officer for the first time, on a fire rig, I was a go-getter. I was that motivated guy. And I had two young firemen with me who were all just as motivated. And we would train 5 or 6 hours a day. And we were exhausted by the end of the day. We would do night drills, we would do day drills. And we all loved it. It wasn't me making them do it. But I had a chief at the time told me, he said, you may not realize it now, but you want to slow it down because you're going to burn yourself and your guys out eventually. And I couldn't get them to stop. And that was a failure of my leadership. And I'm not saying they didn't trust me, but I couldn't get them to understand, guys, we also have to recuperate and we also have to repair our bodies. And I tell a lot of people that I run with now is it's okay to have that day where you're not running or not lifting because you might have to recuperate. That doesn't mean do nothing. But it might mean you're gonna walk or do a ruck with a weighted backpack or because you have to repair your mind. You have to give your mind a rest. And that goes into the whole mental health thing. And so servant leadership has become a hot vocabulary word here recently. And I've seen it work really well in a lot of places, but I've also seen it go bad where servant leadership has also turned into the inmates running the asylum sometimes. When it is inappropriately executed. So here's what I always tell the folks around me, and anytime I talk about leadership, is kind of going back to that PowerPoint that I told you I've created for my folks. I have high expectations for you, and I am absolutely going to hold you accountable. But your job and authority is also to hold me accountable. If you come in and you see that I've been sitting in the recliner all day, which you probably won't find. But let's say that you come in, hey, LT, are you good today? I noticed you didn't get structure done. My guys know I expect that of them because they know that if I come in and I see them in the recliner and they don't have something done, I'm going to say something. which is why I never see it anymore. I always tell them, see something, do something. You see a piece of trash on the ground, pick it up. You see a trash can that's full, empty it, put a new bag in it, right? It's all those little things, those little habits. Making your bed in the morning. Those things seem silly, but those are things that show discipline. If you're willing to do the little things, when we get on the big thing, I know I can count on you.
Absolutely.
So as a leader, again, it's just teaching discipline to my folks, making sure they understand that, you love them, you're on their team, but I am going to hold you accountable. I'm going to have high expectations because I know that you can be better. I know that tomorrow you can be a much better person than you are today. And I started this little thing a couple of years ago where every couple of months, and I do it with them, we have a sheet and we write down physical fitness goals. We write down life goals, educational goals, work goals. And we write them all down. And they all know where their sheet is. And as they accomplish it, they go and they check it off. And I love going in and looking at those sheets periodically. And I see a paper that has all the check marks, or I see a paper that has a check mark and maybe a note. And that's served me well because I know my guys are growing. And I think it's helped them accomplish more things as well because they have a list. Just like having a grocery list, when you see it every single day, it's a reminder, I gotta do that. I can be better. I can improve myself, my family, whatever it may be. And so, kind of that goes into the why. It's not as much the how, but the why. Why are we here? Why are we doing this? We know what the end goal is, but what is your why? Your why in every situation matters. And I always tell people my why. I believe in serving people. And I know in interview processes, or why'd you get in the fire service? I want to help people. We all hate hearing that, right? But at the same time, if you're a servant leader or you're a public servant, and then no matter what that may be, you could be coaching your kids' soccer team through Parks and Rec. You're still being a public servant, right? You're still filling that void that is open for somebody else. And I think, I've always told people, I want to get to the point where somebody that I worked for, or somebody that worked for me, I get to work for one day, because that would be awesome. If I was somebody's company officer and they were my driver, and then they're the chief of the department I work for, like that would be an awesome story to tell. And I know it's happened time and time again. I just haven't gotten to experience that yet.
Okay. I love it. I love your take on it. It's true. I mean, so much to unpack there, but I mean, a lot of it, like you said, keeping yourself accountable. If you're a leader of your shift, not just talking the talk, but walk the walk too. It's as a leader, you want your individuals to work hard, but in return, at least for me, and it sounds like for you too, it's gotta run both ways. Like you can't expect your members to be in it and putting in the work and you're not doing anything but just reaping the reward. Because one of my biggest thing is just because you've made it to the rank of boss, lieutenant, captain, whatever title you want to call it, it doesn't mean all you can do is stand back and point. Especially if you're in an organization where your manpower limited, you will also be required as the leader to know how to do these skills too. So I'm 100% on board with how you stated that.
Yeah, I've heard company officers over the years sometimes say, well, I can't do this because I have this company officer responsibility I have to tend to. It might be the log book or whatever it may be. Sometimes that stuff just has to wait till later in the evening when the guys have laid down for the night, right? That's why the company officer and the boss makes more money. You're expected sometimes to, spend more time on things. Be one of the guys, train with the guys, be just as quick deploying a line as they are. You can catch your logbook up later. You can, answer or send that email later. I'm not saying don't do your job, but
Right.
there's certain things that we make a priority sometimes that don't have to be a priority right that second.
Now facts. Facts. Okay. All right. The topic of firefighter wellness. It's a huge topic. You mentioned and I don't want people to think like it's a cop out because it is a hot topic because it's true. You have certain departments, certain organizations, certain companies, they are running calls. They are getting beat in. And so, schedules and the way your department operates kind of go hand in hand. But you have your own story that you said you wanted to share too on firefighter wellness. So I'm gonna let you have it.
Yeah, so for years I kind of hid what I thought was not a quality. It was a dark place in my life. I battled alcoholism for years, and unfortunately, it took me almost losing my family to finally get on track and get some help with that. And I got in Celebrate Recovery through my church, and I learned that everybody has a hurt habit or a hang up, and it's how you deal with those things. And mental health, I hate how sometimes mental health, you say mental health, people think about suicide and depression and only those two things. But man, mental health is so much more than just suicide and depression. Obviously, we have rising suicide rates in emergency services, and we absolutely need to keep that at the forefront of our mind, and we need to, help find solutions for that. But we need to find people where they're at before it gets to that severe of a situation. And I would say, in college, I probably, or I know I drank way too much, and it just transitioned into, I was drinking every day. I was drinking a lot every day. Luckily, I never went to work impaired or anything like that, but on my days off, I was always drinking, and my wife would come home, and, I thought I was doing all the things right. I had dinner done, and I had all these things, but my wife would come home, and I wasn't present. I wasn't showing up ready to be the husband and the father I needed to be because I was drinking. And I got to a point where it was affecting my marriage, my relationship with my kids. And luckily, I've had my wife who has stood by me, because I can tell you, being the spouse of an alcoholic is a very difficult thing. I've learned that over the years. And my wife isn't as open as talking about it, but spouses of alcoholics, it's just really challenging having to watch your spouse go through that and all that. So, I've been sober for going on 7 years now. And since then, I feel like I have a new lease on life, and I want to help others not get to the point where I got to. And I think one of the hardest things for me has been finally getting back into the circle. The guys go out for a beer. I'm at a point in my sobriety where I can still go out with the guys, and drink a Diet Coke in a glass while they might be having a bourbon. Or, the non-alcoholic beer scene has like blossomed and just exploded in the last couple of years. So I can sit and have a non-alcoholic Corona with my buddies while they're having a regular one. But what I did was, I've noticed th through the years, is people were almost uncomfortable around me. Like, they
Oh,
didn't want
yeah.
to talk about alcohol, or that they didn't want to invite me because, oh, well, Barger struggled with this. And I kind of had to force my way back into those situations. Those guys were still my friends. They still cared about me, but in their mind, they didn't want to put me in a situation I couldn't handle. And I respect that and appreciate that, but I kind of had to wedge myself back in and, like, guys, it's okay. And there is a distinct line between sobriety where people can handle that and sobriety where people can't handle those kinds of things. My uncle's been sober for a number of years. He helped me get sober as well. He can't put himself in those situations. So, like, he won't drink a non-alcoholic beer because he knows that's going to make him want to drink a real beer again. So it's knowing your triggers and having that support system. But, that mental health thing is super important in the fire service. Don't be afraid to use your EAP services at your department. Don't be afraid to reach out to help. And don't be afraid to point out to one of your fellow, firemen or just friends and family outside of work even, hey man, I'm concerned about you. I care about you. I noticed this. I'm not accusing you of anything, but, is everything okay? Just having those little conversations, because it takes knowing that you have a safety net to fall back on. It is a very raw experience to get sober and to not rely on alcohol or even drugs. Drugs was never a thing for me, but I gotta tell you, it was really a eye-opening experience for me, and it was life-changing understanding addiction. I don't believe you ever beat addiction, because I haven't drank in 7 years and I'm sober, but my new addiction is running. So, through that physical fitness thing you talk about, you might be too busy on the rig that day, but that we can't let our bodies go, because we are athletes in the fire service. We are lifting heavy loads. We're lifting uneven loads. We are, your cardiovascular endurance has to be up there. We've all worn air packs, gone to a fire, dragging a line, dragging somebody, whatever it may be. It's physically exerting. You've got to be in tip-top shape. I love the terminology I've heard over the years, people talking about firemen are athletes. That's exactly what we are. And we have to teach ourselves to be athletes. And that goes to the discipline, make sure you're working out, you're eating healthy, keeping your mind clear, all those kinds of things. So I took up running, and because I have an addictive personality, I actually ran my first marathon yesterday. But I've ran 50-mile races, 32-mile races, which is a 50K. I've ran as much as 75-mile races before. And so I've probably taken it in excess. I started off just wanting to run a 5K, and now I'm just beating my body down. I keep telling everybody, they always say, "You're going to need a knee replacement one day." I said, "Probably, but I'm going to have a cool ass story to go along with these broken knees."
Well, I appreciate you sharing your story. That's awesome. It's been 7 years. That's in this, you and I both know in this industry, in this profession, firemen don't like to be vulnerable. They don't like to talk about feelings or their weaknesses or fears or concerns. So it's always great that you put yourself out there because you're tr you know not only you but so many others are trying to change that narrative. And for any fireman out there who and we all know them, the ones that are like, oh, psh, like such and such cried or whatever the case may be, leave your feelings at the door. I think there are a whole lot of organizations that are trying to crush that stigma. To me, if that's how you are and that's your mentality and that's how you continue to be, I'm just not going to be around you. So it's one of those things, man. It's awesome to hear. And you're right. You're right when it comes to how firefighters and not just firefighters, but other people kind of like to tiptoe, like, ooh, should we invite Steve? I don't know. And it's like, if you have the conversation and Steve tells you, hey, yeah, invite me along. I'm just going to have a club soda while you guys have a beer. It is what it is. Like for me, for instance, like if I go out, like when I go to these fire conferences and I partake in the socials, the socials, the time where firemen are going to want to drink. I mean, that's what they do. I don't drink. I've tried it when I was younger and I just didn't like the flavor of it. So it's like for me, I'll either order see if I can get a bottle of water, and then I put a little Crystal Light pack in it, shake it up, and I got my lemonade, and I'm having a great time. Like I don't need that, that type of beverage to have a good time. But if somebody's recovering, don't shy away from that. I think, like you said, it kind of like it starts alienating the person, making them feel a certain type of way about themselves. But I love that you brought that up.
I know a lot of people who have failed in sobriety over the years too, because of that, because they still want to be one of the guys, right? They still want to have those social circles. And I think that's why I'm so excited about, I go and talk periodically to the Christian Recovery Center here in Brunswick County. And I always start my talks about my battle with addiction, all the things I've done and overcome, and this and that. I'm a husband and a father, and I talk about my family. And I say, "I'm also a police officer." And they'll like grab their seats and like, wow. Because I think it's important through this public servant model, community policing, public education in the fire service, that we show that we're real people too, right? Like we still, like we have to mow our grass, we wash our cars, we take our kids to school, pick them up, whatever. Like we have all, we're just regular people. And for years, firefighting is not just a job. You're right. But firefighting is not just who you are. It's not just who I am. And I think sometimes we pigeonhole ourselves into this tunnel that we have to fulfill this assumed persona because that's what this box that a firefighter has to be. It says that, you have to go to these socials and drink a lot and act silly. No, you don't. Like, there was a time in my life because I felt like I had to fit in, that I would get club soda or a Diet Coke with a piece of fruit in a short glass, like a whiskey drink would come in, just so nobody would say, "Oh, he's got a tall water glass, right? Could look different." Now I could care less, but there was a point in my life where I can't drink, I don't want to drink, but I want to be part of it, but I gotta look like it, right? And then, I mean, now I look back and I laugh and go, "Well, damn, that was silly." But it evolves. Like as you experience those things, it evolves. But that's why I'm so passionate to tell people is you can be a great fireman. You can drink beer, but you don't have to do it in excess.
Right.
But
No.
again, I'm just passionate about people saving their families, not losing their wife and their kids like I almost did. I'm grateful to God every day that my wife stuck by me, and my marriage and my relationship with my kids is better today because I'm sober. And I just want to make sure. And again, I don't fault anybody who drinks, and I think that's the other thing that sometimes people assume. Oh, you want to drink in front of Steve? He's gonna judge you. No judgment here. There's
Right.
plenty of people that can go out and have a beer, or even a couple beers, and be totally fine. I'm not that guy. I've never drank just one beer in my life. You know what I mean? And
Right.
so, but everybody has a hurt habit or hang up or something. You know,
Yeah.
some people just spend money in exorbitant ways and have astronomical debt. That's their addiction. So I'm passionate about just helping everybody show up present and being better every day, I think.
No, you're right. I mean, I don't think you couldn't have said it any better. I think as there's a period in every firefighter's life where you want to be into that in crowd. You want to fit in and you'll do whatever it is to fit in. But like, I hope as you get older, like you start realizing and looking back, like to me, everybody has done something that they could have not done that earlier, or it's like I should have made wiser decisions. But I think as you get older, hopefully, especially when you bring in like marriage and children, your mindset should start to change where it's like I don't want to be like for me, for instance, I've never been, the in crowd guy. Like I'm always kind of out to the side, an extrovert, just kind of looking in, and if I have people to talk to, cool. If not, then cool. But like, I'm at a point in my career where what if what I do makes you feel uncomfortable or you feel like you have to make a joke of it? Well, then what is that saying about you? Like everybody has insecurities. The whole of verbiage or adage that everybody has skeletons in their closet. No one's perfect. So I hate the fact, like, especially nowadays, whenever we hear something about an individual, we just start the rumor mill and gossip, and it's like, okay. If somebody hired a person to do a deep dive on you, what are they going to find? Like, you're not going to be squeaky clean. Nobody is. So it's like we have no right to judge people over their actions. If they're trying to help themselves and improve, why not lift them up? As one thing for sure, I can say the fire service is great. I hate that. Like the fire service will show its brotherhood and like familyness whenever it's a tragedy, funerals, cancer raffles, whatever, benefit raffles. But like we can also like eat our own to the point where sometimes that person just leaves the whole service altogether. Like it could be very, I don't want to say demonic, but like downright dirty how some individuals can act towards each other. So I 100% love that, you're open and that you've successfully gone through your sobriety and you continue to do so. And yes, that whole thing of it's great to be known as the firefighter. Like, that's the guy or girl you want on their truck and whatnot. But hopefully that's not all that you have because, contrary to popular belief, you're replaceable. You'll be replaced like that. Like it's okay. Today's such and such retirement day. Cool. We're gonna do a little thing. Have companies rotate, and then the next day, bro, you're done. Like you're replaced. Your replacement's already on the truck. It's ready to go. So hopefully, your identity is not just the fire service, like you stated.
I remember when I first walked into a fire station that had somebody's name on the front of it, the XYZ person's firehouse or whatever it may be. You have no idea who that person is. Nobody
Right.
working in that firehouse typically knows who that person is. And I'm not saying they didn't have a storied career and they didn't help thousands or hundreds or whatever number of people, but you're exactly right. The day you leave, you think you're very important today, and the department probably thinks you're very important today, but when you leave tomorrow, there's going to be somebody else riding your seat, wearing your boots. And when you get home, I've met a lot of retired first responders over the years that their kids don't care how good of a fireman they were.
Right.
It's how much time you spent with your kids or with your family. And again, I'm not trying to say don't dedicate 100% to your job when you're there. That is absolutely it. And I think being a good leader and a good company officer is you make yourself available to your guys, even outside the firehouse. Like, that's important. But you've got to set aside that uninterrupted family time with your family. But it's so important. And you've got to make sure that your mental health and your physical fitness is also in line with that, because that's also very important. Like, we have to address the elephant in the room. Like, there was an article in 2015. I think the guy's name was Haddock. He said 50% of firemen are reporting excessive drinking in the last 30 days, compared to 30% of the general public. We have to acknowledge those things. We have to acknowledge our divorce rates are higher, and not just say, "Oh, it's part of the job." It doesn't have to be part of the job. For years, people wrote on the billboard of apparatuses. They don't now. Even though I think it would be super cool, and I've often considered being a garbage man just so I could write on the tailboard or something. But we have to evolve. We have to remember that we're human and get our priorities in line and making sure that we are showing up present every single day in every situation.
No, you're right. You're 100% right. And I kind of lead it to which, I mean, it could be a great thing, it can be a bad thing. Like the way social media portrays with all these pages that are dedicated to being good at the job, learning the craft. I get it. Like we should. That's what the public expects from us. But don't let that be your identity. You know, don't be the Bruce Wayne. And I love Bruce Wayne. I'm a huge like comic book fan and you know, heroic, you know, action fan of different individuals. But don't Bruce Wayne, as you notice, had all the money, could do whatever he wants, but had no family. Okay, he had Alfred. Alfred's gonna die. Alfred never dies, but when Alfred dies, who does he have? Nobody. Like, you have to make sure you're setting yourself up for something besides that. So I don't want to keep beating a dead horse, but I love that you mentioned it, and I think it's important that we talk about it. You know, I tell my newer firefighters that I have, you know, most firefighters have part-time jobs. Some of them have trade skills, which is awesome, but a lot of them will work at this part-time fire department, this part-time fire department. And I tell, you know, I've told the new ones I have, like, hey, try to find something else where you don't get burned out, because learn from experience. Like at one point I worked at three different fire departments. Like, it's cool, it's easy money, but it can get tiring, and you could just, all you're doing is changing a shirt, doing the exact same job at another organization. So, you know, keep in mind, find something that you truly love and can have passion for outside the your department. But with that being said, though, Steven, I really appreciate you coming on, wanting to talk shop, being very honest and open and vulnerable, letting people know, you know, certain things about you. That's not very easy. A lot of people don't want to do that. Nobody really wants to be, I don't want to say truthful, but people like to hide by, you know, behind a persona that, you know, they're perfect, and nobody is. That's what I want people to understand. Nobody is. The best thing you could do is expose your weaknesses and work on them and learn to improve it. And remember that, yes, like you stated earlier, family first. You know, fire is always going to be here. The fire department's a business. Whether you agree with that statement or not, it's a business. It'll keep going well after you're gone. So I appreciate you coming on and talking.
Yeah, knocking down those barriers in the fire service and just in life in general, I think is really important. I think it goes right back to the first thing we talked about, which is trust. Trust in your leader, trust in your people. And the more people show their real person, who they are outside the firehouse, it builds that trust. That's that raw trust, raw emotion that it takes to be a great company. And so, I think I try to knock down those barriers every day. I always tell my folks, I want to know your wife's name. I want to know your kid's name. I want to know about your family, because that lets you know I care about you. And I
No.
think that knocking down those barriers for folks, putting people first and putting first things first, is super important. And, kind of as we wind it down here, there's a book, Leadership Isn't for Cowards. And the first line in the book, or in the first chapter, it says you're messing with people's lives with every decision you make. And so we got to make sure that we're building that trust. When we make those hard decisions, people know that we're making it for the right reasons.
Absolutely. And one thing you said that stuck out to me, which I mean, I can see it, and I don't know what father or mother or whatever would be cool with hearing your child show up to your retirement party and everybody around or everybody that's there tells your child, hey, your dad or your mom was an awesome firefighter. I'd love to have him. Wouldn't that be something if your child goes, that's great. I wish that they were also a better parent as they were a firefighter. Like if that doesn't strike a chord, if that doesn't for guys, if that doesn't kick you in the balls, like that's something you need to think about. Okay, yeah, your dad was awesome, jam up. But if your child was like, you were a shitty parent, was it worth it? And I'll leave it at that. But Steven, like I said, I really appreciate you coming on, man. Talking shop. This has been very eye-opening. I have never thought about a department out there that operates the way you guys do. Very unique, very challenging, but you guys get it done 24/7, 365. So that's awesome. To your membership of Bald Head Island, keep doing what you guys doing. Keep fighting the good fight, as they say.
Yes, sir. Yeah, we have a really unique situation. We've got a great core group of folks who come in every single day, present, ready to work, and ready to answer the call when it comes in. Whether it's every day or every third day, they're always ready.
Definitely. Like I said, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
If any of the listeners out there are or know of a great firefighter who embodies the principles of being a great communicator, goal-oriented, hardworking, humble, passionate, and professional, regardless of rank, career, or volunteer, contact me at studentofthegamefirepodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, stay focused, stay committed, and stay safe.